underneath the concrete jungle of Kalamazoo. Anarchy on the airway.
The People's Power Hour on 89.1 WIDR.
Now, he's a spoiled brat. Tried the nice guy who's cooperating with the president.
So now, can you hear us?
Okay, yes.
All right.
Introduction one more time. We're speaking with Gloria LaRiva from the International Answer Coalition, and we're going to be speaking tonight about the case of Luis Posada and also about the Cuban Five. Gloria, can you tell us a little bit about Luis Posada? Who is he? What is his background?
Well, Luis Posada Carriles is a Cuban-born national who is also now a Venezuelan citizen. And he is basically a CIA agent since 1960, about 1 year after the Cuban Revolution of 1959. He was working with the Batista, the dictator Batista's police in the 1950s in Cuba. And he's a fascist who became a CIA agent for the U.S. He was trained in Fort Benning in the early 60s. His expertise was explosives and sabotage. And he's used those so-called skills ever since then to create havoc and terror, murdering dozens of people. For example, he paid two mercenaries to plant bombs on a Cuban airliner in 1976, which killed 73 people. And he's had one incident after another of leading terrorist activities of mainly paying other mercenaries to plant bombs in public places, killing people. He was also notorious for having been the go-between between Oliver North in El Salvador in supplying guns through drug running to the Nicaraguan counter-revolutionaries, which itself also helped kill many, many people in the counter-revolutionary war in Nicaragua. So Posada Carriles is, in short, a terrorist.
Now he...
And his last crime was trying to assassinate Fidel Castro in the year 2000. He was pardoned by the Panamanian president, who was a Bushite, Miriam Moscoso, along with three other terrorists who were trying to kill Fidel Castro. And he ended up, 7 months later, sneaking into the United States last March. The Answer Coalition and other organizations have a national campaign to demand his extradition to Venezuela so that he can be tried for the crime of the Cuban airliner bombing that, again, as I said, killed 73 people.
And he entered the United States illegally, and he's currently facing deportation charges. And would it be correct to assume that the federal government is actually trying to deport him, yet his lawyers, his defense attorneys are probably more in line, their wishes are more in line with that of the Bush administration?
Well, unfortunately, but not a surprise, the Homeland Security, which is prosecuting the case, is also coming to an agreement, apparently, in the last days with the defendant lawyers, Posada's lawyers, to have him probably remain in the U.S. indefinitely, detained, but always at any moment's notice, able to be freed, as his accomplice in the bombing, Orlando Bosch, was done in 1990 when George Bush Sr. gave him essentially a pardon. Orlando Bosch, who was the co-conspirator in the bombing of the plane, walks the streets freely in Miami and has sworn to permanently carry out terrorism. But Posada miscalculated because he thought by coming into Miami he'd get the same treatment. However, worldwide opinion and opposition in the U.S. is what forced Homeland Security to arrest him 2 months after he got in here. But in the trial that took place this week in El Paso, where I was, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, it was only on immigration charges. It was a deportation hearing. And that is a bogus process, because what should take precedence is an extradition process. The extradition process has precedence over any other legal matter in the U.S. because, first, it came first, and second, it is required by three international laws, and including a treaty between the U.S. and Venezuela from 1922, requiring extradition when someone is suspected of, and when there's enough evidence to say that there's reasons to extradite him. However, what took place in El Paso this week was, again, a deportation hearing. And at first the judge said he ordered that if he's ruled deportable, they would deport him to Venezuela. And Homeland Security attorneys said that's fine with us. The defense attorneys, of course, said he couldn't be sent there. But on Tuesday, the second day of the hearing, a very notorious man named Joaquin Chafardet, who was originally part of the secret police that Posada had originally had belonged to in the 1970s, and Posada himself brags openly that he killed many leftists, many young people in Venezuela. He tortured them in the 70s. And this man, Chafardet, who was his partner in that secret police, he came to El Paso and testified that if Posada were extradited to or deported to Venezuela after this hearing, that he would be tortured. And, oh, then suddenly kicks in the CAT, the Convention Against Torture, which is the one thing that the U.S. can use to say, oh, the suspicion that he may be tortured in another country, we cannot deport him, even though we have ruled him deportable. This is called deferral of removal or deferral of deportation. And that's the very convenient loophole that both the judge and the prosecution, in the name of the U.S. government, apparently is going to use now to let him stay in the U.S.
This is really fascinating, seeing as how, you know, suspected terrorists now, we often deport them to countries that we know practice torture in order for them to be tortured.
Yes, and it's really something coming from a man who has spent his whole life torturing people. His book, The Secret of the Warrior, or The Road of the Warrior, something like that, in his book, he says openly, we tried to hurt them as much as we could, and then we killed them, the people in Venezuela. And the people on the plane that exploded in 1976 as it was taken out from Barbados in the Caribbean, those poor people were burned to death before they hit water, where they wouldn't have survived either. I mean, that is torture. That is terror. But he is a U.S. terrorist. So he's okay. His attorney calls him a freedom fighter.
He also bragged to the New York Times.
Unfortunately, we had a tremendous protest out front. We had the pictures of every victim of the plane bombing on display on a wall that we built over there. And in the hearing, the Homeland Security attorney, supposedly the prosecution, didn't even present the case of the plane bombing against him.
That's amazing.
She used lesser charges against him. And probably why she didn't do it was it's linked with Venezuela, because that's where he planned the bombing. And I don't think that she or the government want to present a case that's linked to Venezuela. So it's still in the air. The hearing was postponed until September 26th. And we expect to be out there again. We had two sisters of one of the plane victims who died on the plane. They were with us, and they spoke in a very moving way about what it meant for them to get justice, that they're looking for justice after 30 years.
I've actually heard that in the New York Times. Hello, are you with us still?
Yes.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
I'm sorry. I actually heard that he bragged in the New York Times about a series of bombings that were carried out in 1997 in Havana. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, it's a very significant interview that was done with the author, Anne-Louise Bardach, her name is B-A-R-D-A-C-H, and she did interviews with him in Aruba. He wanted to basically brag about his exploits. So she met with him over a period of days. She interviewed him almost entirely by tape recording. And in it, as you say, in 1998, when this interview was done, he bragged about the hotel bombings, a spate of bombings in Cuban hotels, Havana hotels. And he says in the interview, I did it because I wanted to destroy Cuba's tourism industry. And he bragged that he had received money from members of the Cuban American National Foundation in Florida, which is financed again by the National Endowment of Democracy, a U.S. institute.
Interesting.
He also basically just said straight up that he hired Guatemalan and Salvadoran mercenaries to go to El Salvador, to go to Cuba. He paid them, bought their tickets so they could go to Cuba, and he paid them several thousand dollars for each bomb that they planted. So these people would sit in a lobby of a hotel. They would, you know, let down their bag or their backpack and stick it under the furniture and walk away and leave any innocent person walking by in a hotel to die. Well, one of those people who died was Fabio Di Chelmo. And he was a 27-year-old Italian tourist at the Copacabana Hotel. And he was walking through the lobby when this bomb exploded and just severed his neck jugular. And he bled to death in 1 minute. This is, and in the interview, Posada said, that Italian was sitting in the wrong place at the wrong time. And I don't lose any sleep over it. I sleep like a baby. So because of that interview, it was very, very self-incriminating. And in the trial this week, this hearing, the prosecution brought it up, and it was very strange because he denied all of it. He said that he didn't understand English, and that's not what he said. He didn't understand what the reporter was saying. And so he was trying to excuse all of his bragging 8 years ago, or 7 years ago. And the funny thing in the hearing was that every time the prosecution asked him a question in English, it was always translated, but he didn't wait for the Spanish translation to answer her. And during the 3 days of the hearing, or the second day when he started testifying, he was correcting the translation into English of the translator. He knows English better than he lets on.
Mm.
So it's a very, this is all a long story and a very complicated situation. But basically, it's the U.S. government that has financed and armed, given the green light to these anti-Cuba terrorists, of whom hundreds reside in Miami. And they have inflicted so much damage on Cuba that 3,400 Cubans have died by sabotage, bacteriological warfare, bombings, assassination, including people in the U.S. And this is a case that must be our concern because it's, first of all, in the U.S. Second, it's financed by the U.S. Third, these kind of restrictions against travel abroad are the very reason why we don't know the truth about Cuba. And someone like Posada Carriles is in the service of the U.S. to be able to terrorize people from going to Cuba. It's all part of the plan that has been stepped up by the Bush administration through what they announced a year and a half ago called the, you probably heard about it, the Commission for Transition to a New Cuba.
Okay.
Have you heard about it?
No, I have not.
Has anyone in the interview been hearing about it?
No, I haven't.
No.
Fill us in.
Well, this is another, you know, well-kept secret, but it's a huge increase in the aggression against Cuba. And basically, in May 2003, the Bush administration announced that it would be unveiling a new organization called the Commission for Transition to a New Cuba. It was headed up by Colin Powell. Now it's being chaired by Condoleezza Rice. And it involves every U.S. department, state, treasury, commerce, even housing, homeland security, every government department and cabinet post. The idea of the plan, which is about 480 pages, it details, very, very detailed, how the U.S. will basically take over the country, and that they will allow no successor to Fidel Castro, that when he dies, they say, they will prevent anybody currently in the government from succeeding him. And if anybody knows anything about Cuba, even the most basic thing, that's a call to counter-revolution. That's a call to war. It provides for $59 million in funding to very small counter-revolutionary organizations inside Cuba, which are being created by big money that the U.S. is pumping in, because unfortunately there are people who will sell their soul. $59 million to foment what they call dissent. Interference in another country.
It's very interesting. Speaking of all this, you know, anti-Cuban terrorism generating out of Miami and the U.S. doing little about it, Maybe we can transition now to talk about the Cuban Five a little bit, because essentially my understanding is that this was an intelligence operation launched by Cuba to try and defend their country somewhat from these terrorists.
Well, yeah, I think we need to be careful about our words, and I don't blame you. It's that words like espionage and intelligence are linked to the idea of espionage on the U.S. government. In legal terms, espionage or espionage conspiracy is involved in getting information of national security, of U.S., of the U.S., national security, of confidential information,
okay,
top secret information. The Cuban Five were a group of men from Cuba who were sent into Miami in the early 1990s. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, its biggest ally, the Cubans began to experience the aggression by the U.S., the tightening of the blockade, increased military flights, more threats against Cuba. And so they sent these men in to Miami to infiltrate terrorist organizations, the ones I've spoken about, financed by the CIA. And these men came in the early 90s. They were working peacefully. They didn't have weapons. They just had their eyes and ears. They reported not only to the Cuban government, but even to the FBI, of boatloads of guns, contraband to send to Cuba and fire on hotels. They uncovered two plane bombings that they prevented. And those people who were on those planes don't even know that their lives were saved by these men's actions. But they infiltrated fascist organizations that the U.S. finances, and the U.S. is aware that this happens. So they were searching for these men, and over a series of years with surveillance and so on, they uncovered the existence of the five men and arrested them on September 12, 1998. The FBI arrested them in a vengeful campaign to try to root out Cubans who, for patriotic and just humanitarian reasons, were sacrificing their life to stop the terrorist groups like the Ku Klux, like they would be like the Ku Klux Klan in our country, from attacking Cuba or attacking planes just because they fly to Cuba. So it's a long story, but they were basically tried in Miami despite five motions by the defense to move the trial out of Miami, given that El Yon had just happened and the right wing was just whipped up there. The defense attorneys argued that the Cuban Five could never be fairly tried in that city, and they lost the case. They lost the change for venue. They lost the trial. They were convicted on all 26 charges of espionage conspiracy and other related charges like failing to register as a foreign agent. They were sentenced to the toughest and additional sentences, four life terms, 85 years. But amazingly, last August 9th, not even a month ago, the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals in Atlanta just overturned all their convictions.
And ordered it for a new trial in a different location.
Yeah, they ordered a new trial in another city, but it's a very, very big victory. It's nobody, I think, could have guessed that this would be the outcome, even though the attorneys prepared for it and argued it brilliantly. It's the first time ever in U.S. history, to show you that it is truly a precedent, it's the first time in U.S. history that a federal appeals court has overturned a federal district court trial based on venue. First time it ever happened.
And unanimously, is correct?
Yes, unanimously. Unanimously, but it shows how rotten the trial process was in the original trial, how absolutely rotten, that even though they had this giant obstacle to overcome, they had a number of obstacles to overcome in the appeals, the 11th Circuit Court, which is considered the most conservative appeals court, actually was far more liberal than what took place in Miami, apparently, from what we read. And you can see the findings on our website. You can read the whole decision of this appeal, and it's really great reading. On freethefive.org, and five is spelled out, but it's called www.freethefive.org.
What was the role of the United Nations Working Group on Arbitrary Detentions in getting this reversal?
Well, not many people are aware of all the different appeals and legal procedures that one can go through in international arenas, like the world, you know, the courts in Latin America, even the Organization of American States. But at the United Nations and the Human Rights Commission in Geneva, which meets every year, there are quite a number of cases that come up about from any country about human rights abuses. And the attorneys help to provide the evidence to the working group. It's called the Working Group on Arbitrary Detentions of the United Nations Human Rights Commission. And after a lengthy time in studying the case, they came up with a conclusion about maybe 2 weeks before the court decision. And the Working Group on Arbitrary Detention said that the men were indeed placed in isolation for 17 months after arrest, effectively denying them sufficient time to prepare their defense or communications, that they should never have been tried in Miami, that their families were being abused by not being allowed to have entry into the U.S. to visit their loved ones. Two wives were prohibited permanently from the U.S. A number of charges, and the working group said, we call on the U.S. government to remedy this situation forthwith. So I think that, plus all the organizing that's going on, our publicity efforts, so many things, 200 groups around the world, all of this has helped bear pressure on, you know, at least not on the judges, but in the whole atmosphere. And I think in addition, the entry into Miami, this nest of terrorists, the entrance into Miami of Luis Posada Carriles, must have had some sort of influence, not influence, but effect in awakening people's ignorance about the danger that exists in Miami of people who are driven toward terror.
So, pending a new trial, what is the status of the Cuban Five right now?
Well, they should be freed. We think they should be freed. We think they were innocent all along. But the indictments still stand. The 26 federal charges still exist. The trial has been ruled, you know, they've been ruled a new trial, and that can take over a year to start off. The government has 6 months to start the process, but they can drag it out. In the meantime, we think about by the end of September, they will be from their present prisons and sent back to Miami to start the hearings for a new trial, in which case the judge may remove herself from the case or nominate somebody else for the case, and in which case they will determine where to go from there. The government doesn't have to try them, and we think that a public campaign could help force the government to free them today.
Okay. Gloria LaRiva, thanks for talking to us about the Cuban Five in the case of Luis Posada, and can you give us the website one more time where people can find more information about this?
Yeah, and we have people in the Midwest. There's a number of committees there, and if you look up on the website, www.freethefive.org, and five is spelled out, you can look on the contact box, and there are many committees listed near you. You can also read all the information on our site. We hope the readers or the listeners will take time to find out more about the case. It involves the issue of Cuba's right to live, to be sovereign, and to be free of terrorism, and any people's right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.